spend my dollar.
It's not about what you want. It's about what you're willing to do to get it. Run it again.
Hello and welcome.
I'm not going to, so quit asking.
When you give me a hard time.
For the listeners that didn't get to go.
This is the payback.
Alabama wins!
What you did last year really doesn't matter.
Our goal is to have the kind of team that nobody wants to play.
Hi.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. Folks, Alabama's 52-3 dismantling of Arkansas, you know, it really is a big deal. It's a big deal for all the obvious reasons. Anytime you have a conference win by 49 points, it's also a big deal for a lot of, you know, call it less obvious reasons, a lot of sort of unconventional reasons connected to just the 2020 season and the oddity of the Rona season. You know, if we think about the Arkansas game, this game has had three dates that have been circled and allocated for this game. There's the original 2020 schedule, the original 10 SEC conference game schedule, and then the reschedule to accommodate the miss with LSU. And so there's a lot that has gone into that, sort of almost a microcosm representing all of the challenges and difficulties that have gone into the season as a whole, certainly the execution of this game as well. I think as SEC fans, maybe not Florida fans, but SEC fans, I think there's a degree of pride in seeing the season play through its full schedule. There are a couple of exceptions, but as the rule, you know, the two champions played 10 games, or the two East and West champions played 10 games. A lot of conferences are literally making up the rules as they go. They've gone through a long, elongated sort of gyrations to invent a structure and rules, and they are just sweeping them out sort of on the fly. And so I appreciate sort of the tenacity or veracity of the SEC to stick with the schedule that they put out, or at least the intentionality of the schedule as they've put out. And I think, again, a testament to the vision of the conference as well as this Alabama team to march through this season. Even though we predicted it, it's still a whole nother thing to see it. Alabama marched through this season with relative ease. And we did predict that, maybe a little preseason full of ourselves, but to see on the other end that actually play out, I think that's great. I think that's phenomenal. And we should all have a great deal of pride in this team. There was an article Saturday down south I read earlier this Sunday morning, and I forget even the full article, but the headline caught my eye, and I wish I'd thought of it first, but they said the past is prologue. I had been thinking this morning, what do I want to say on the show? And because I do think there's an occasion to this that's different than just a regular regular week to week. We're now transitioning. There's an inflection point from the regular season to the playoffs. I know in the SEC we call the championship week part of the regular schedule. I respect that, but it's a championship, different from the regular season. And so when we think of past as prologue, we think of flipping the switch from regular season to sort of more of a playoff mode. That's where the team sits right now. That's where the conference sits right now. In some respects, that's where college football sits right now. And so we want to look forward because that's where the big prizes are. But let's definitely take a moment and break down the Arkansas game, you know, much like we do. I think this game, in sort of a weird way, I think this game, and we've seen this the last couple of weeks, where the team will show something, the opponent will show something, and Alabama will have to respond and react, and they always do that in a favorable manner. And so every time Alabama has had to respond or react to circumstances, it largely has demonstrated the dominance of the team. It has demonstrated that, hey, that's a gear, that's an angle, that's a wrinkle that the team has that – we probably assumed that it did, but we didn't know until we saw it. And so when I think about, and I was thinking about it during the game, Arkansas came at us with a completely different sort of defensive attack. The offensive, you look at the numbers, you look at the performance, they were completely different. And sort of the vision, I guess I'm a child of the 80s and 90s, but it made me think of one of the early Predator movies. And there was a scene in the movie, I think it was the Danny Glover version, I think it was sort of the worst of the franchise, but there was a scene in that movie where they're hunting the Predator, and they get some crazy idea about they're going to do, I think they use fire extinguishers or something, but they're going to use some sort of gas that is going to blind because the predators track based on body heat and stuff like that. And so they're going to use this gas and it's going to blind the predator and they're going to be able to attack them. And so that's Arkansas. That's what they did. They said, oh, Alabama, they attack this way. So we're going to defend them in that way. We're going to take that away. And then that's going to create, call it a level playing field. And the predator, and this is sort of a sinister scene, you know, kind of in the movie, because they, oh, we've got them. This is our plan. And then the predator just looks and then adjusts something on his armband. And then that completely changes the focus that sort of the line of sight or the vision protocol that the predator is using. And I remember thinking, however I was at the time, like, damn it, this thing is even tougher than we thought it was. And damn it, this Alabama team is probably tougher than we thought it was. The patience that the team executed or demonstrated in the execution of the plan Saturday was phenomenal. Here's some thoughts, right? And so, I watch this on TV. Certainly, Saban has cooler words for it. Saban said, "Oh, they played 33 crowd and a cloud, and we were prepared for that." And I was like, "Well, I don't have the cool sort of vernacular, but they played three deep safeties. That's what I saw, a three deep safety shell. There were a couple of times they were playing quarters coverage in the back end, and so it was all about keeping the play in front of them." Sometimes they put eight defenders back in coverage because they wanted to keep the play in front. And so rather than getting beat, we've seen teams earlier in the season, they say they're going to stack up. They'll give up the long play because they're going to stack up and stop the run. And then Alabama has thrown a lot of long passes. Arkansas sort of flipped that, and they did the opposite of that. We're going to put a hard shell on the top end, and so you're not going to penetrate with the long passes, and we're going to make you beat us methodically down the field. Probably that's a really good strategy. Probably what that does is it creates a situation where there's more opportunity for the offense to make mistakes. Drives are a little longer. It slows down the game. And then as the offense drives down the field, the amount of field to be defended gets smaller and it becomes harder to move the ball as opposed to just throwing 60, 70, 80 yard, passes down the play. So on paper, that makes sense. And, but what's the saying? They don't play the game on paper. And so, think of these statistics when you think about almost a reinvention, and it's not rocket science, right? But when we think about Arkansas attacking, or defensively, setting up, a defensive Alabama, that's almost the exact opposite of what most other teams have done. Take that in mind when you think of the metrics that this Alabama team put up on this game. So short passing game had some success running, but mostly Arkansas did a good job of stifling the run, and so it became a short passing game. And so Mack was efficient as ever. He was 24 of 29, but only 208 yards as opposed to 308 yards or 408 yards, which we've seen before, but it was the short passing game. And we saw almost a rotation of weaponry. When we think about the predator who sort of recast his vision or reset his vision based on the circumstance, well, Alabama just flips the Rolodex and distributes the ball to a different set of personnel. And so Miller Forrestall had six catches. That's a high for his career. Only 52 yards. But six catches for 52 yards, that's a lot of completions, that's a lot of dings, a lot of dunks, a lot of moving the ball down the field. Brian Robinson certainly had three rushing touchdowns on the day, but he had four catches for 22 yards. And so, again, he was incorporated into the passing game. Slade, he had four catches for 43, and that's probably not off what he was doing before. But, again, his sort of attack has always been in the short passing game. So to see him sort of have a standard stat line, if you will, is representative of that mode of attack. And then Smitty, he wasn't completely shut out of the passing game, but he did only have three catches and he did only have 22 yards. And think about this. And again, rotating the weapons, but still managing to be effective. Smitty was the fifth, if you rank in rank order, by number of catches, number of receptions, Smitty was our fifth leading receiver. If you rank in terms of yardage, Smitty's 22 yardage 22 yards, is tied for fourth with Brian Robinson, who also had 22 yards. So it was interesting to see the rotation of some of the personnel having stronger roles or more active roles than they might normally would. But also keep in mind that this did not equal a lack of production. It's just a different flavor of production. Alabama had 24 first downs. Alabama had 443 total yards. Alabama was 10 of 14 on third down conversions. Alabama led the time of possession, which is typically something on average doesn't happen. Oh, and by the way, Alabama scored 52 points. And all of those were offensive points. We can talk about turnover. There were a couple of short fields that were provided. The running game, while neither Najee or Brian Robinson had tremendous days yardage-wise running the ball, Najee had 46, Brian Robinson had 54. Together, they accounted for 5 touchdowns. And so they were getting these short yardage runs. Najee had 2, and Brian Robinson had 3. Later in the game, Jace McClellan had an 80-yard run for a touchdown, which completely sort of skews all of the running stats because you have a one run for 80 yards. But if you discount that and sort of the meat of the ball game, it was very short runs. It was the defense really keeping everything in front of them. But Alabama still managed, turnovers helped, still managed to have quite a dominant day offensively. Talk about another freshman receivers. Javon Baker had 2 catches. These were his first catches of the season. One went for no yards. He had another for 15, which again, distance wise, yardage wise, was one of the leading plays of the day. I think there were only, looking through my notes, I think there were only 2 passing plays that, in fact, I believe there were only 2 plays on the day that went for more than 17 yards. And one of those was the 80-yard run. And there was a 22, 23-yard catch by Mechie. And so all of the offensive production was short yardage. And so there's a little bit of patience. There's a little bit of stick-to-itiveness. But still, Alabama had 5 consecutive touchdowns through the first, second, and into the third quarter, which was nice to see them score coming out of half. That's a metric that we've been watching. 5 consecutive possessions in which touchdowns were scored. This also, and again, you think about an Arkansas defense having some success, but here's where they didn't have success. All of these numbers, all of this production, Alabama had a 35-point margin at half. It was 38-3, 35-point margin, which is the largest of the season. This comes off last week, the LSU game, where Alabama had 45 points at half, which was the highest total. So this offense continues to tweak and evolve and get better. And whatever the challenge is that is set before it, Alabama doesn't just get through it, doesn't just get around it, get by it. It dominates it. It dominates it. It almost destroys the opposition. And so now you think of pick your poison. Alabama can beat you deep in the passing game, and it's not just a slogan. It's not just a T-shirt. It is for reals. Go back and watch the tape. And definitively, if you want to take away the long play, we've now seen Alabama, not the theory of it, but we've seen it in effect. Alabama can be dominating while leading a short passing attack. A couple of complaints. I believe there were some dirty tackles by the Arkansas. I'm not going to sort of get into that, but I think there was some chintzy play there, and the field was just crappy. I look at it as it wasn't like losing the grass or losing the turf from extensive play. There were just parts where it were yellowing. The grass was yellowing. Some of that's going to be a little temperature and a little bit of weather. It looked to me like I do this in my own yard. If I cut it too short, if I've let it grow a little long and I want to cut it back, then what happens is the grass underneath isn't getting as much sun, and so it'll yellow. And so it looked like, and I do that probably once every 2 years in my yard, and I always get pissed at myself when I do it. And so when I looked at their fields, that's the first thing that I look at. That's the first thing I noticed. The yellowing, the streaking, you could almost see the mower blade that was causing that. And what happens in my yard, that's what it looks like. And so I honestly just looked like they cut the grass too low and the underneath wasn't getting as much sunlight. And so it had not greened probably, if we go back and look at their field Tuesday or Wednesday, it'll be flush, it'll be green, and it'll look all right, you know, probably middle of next week. But I thought that was a pretty crappy job. And again, I'm not an expert by any means, but that's certainly what I saw. So that's what you get. You get a little play-by-play on the groundskeeping as well. Also, man, the announcers were just awful. They tried to call the game, the first quarter of the game, wearing their masks, which is about the dumbest thing in the world. I understand wearing the masks. It's important. I understand that. But if you're calling a game where you need to or just on TV in general, where you are communicating, you need to articulate clearly, a mask does not help. It muffles you. And then, you know, at one point they spent about 15 minutes arguing about NFL quarterbacks. I'm watching an Alabama game. I don't give a rat's about NFL quarterbacks. I know sort of the jumping off point to that was talking about Mac Jones. Have a 2-minute talk about Mac Jones. Weave it into the play call of the game, but don't take a 15-minute sort of tirade talking about NFL quarterbacks. For all the slack, for all sort of the ill will that Gary Danielson gets when he calls a game, he's not perfect, but he's not nearly as bad as this crew was. And so I say, give me Gary Danielson every week. Let me run back through my notes. Offensive line, can't talk enough about the offensive line. Evan Neal missed the game. We think it was contact tracing because Amari Kite is his roommate. And we think, and they're not, you know, this is all speculative because they're not announcing in the HIPAA rules and stuff like that. So I'm not breaking news. I'm just sharing what I've heard unofficially. And Amari Kite tested positive for the COVID. And because they're roommates, Evan, who himself may not have tested positive, but because they're roommates, they said, let's put a shell around this from it potentially spreading further across the team. Makes a lot of sense. That's a safety protocol. We can get mad at it. We cannot like it. But if it turns out that Evan had it, then him playing and spreading it to the rest of the team is going to be worse. And so let's accept the limited withholding Evan from an abundance of caution rather than run a bigger risk. And I guarantee you, if an opponent were doing that and playing that opponent or playing that individual and it impacted our team, we can guarantee that we would be a little salty about that. So let's live with it. And if nothing else, that gives Evan an opportunity to get healthy and get well. And by the way, Chris Owens, I thought, acquitted himself very, very well. There was a point where Landon looked like he was wearing a big sort of ice pack on his shoulder. It looked like that was just, I looked sort of big and bandagey and it looked sort of bad, but he was standing on the sideline just laughing and cutting up. And you could look at it and tell, you know, they're wrapping ice on that elbow. So it's not all bandaging, that's ice. At one point he had to get taped up. I think it was his hand, and missed some play. So Dalcourt got some extended run, and so that was good to see him. I thought he did well. Those are a couple of little nuancey things across the offensive line, at least from a personnel standpoint. We did see a lot of the backups rotate in later, but the front offensive line, I think they look good. I think they're going to be full go next week against Florida. All right, if we're going to go mini game ball on offense, I'm going Chris Owens. For reasons that we've talked about, the Alabama offensive line, I think, is quite dominating. Go ahead and send them the Joe Moore Award for best offensive line in the country. And when you have that type of line, you can rotate a guy in, but that can also sort of throw off the chemistry. And so Chris Owens had a couple of days within practice, within the week, within practices, to start getting some reps at the right tackle position. And I thought, for the by and large, he acquitted himself very well. And there's a lot of angst. It's too early for this, folks. It's too early, but there's a lot of angst. What are we going to do across the offensive line next year? You know what? We're going to figure that out in spring. We're not going to figure it out in December while we're still waiting and optimistic about the fortunes and futures of this season. Let's not taint what is still left of this season worrying about the offensive line next October, because hell, that's a year from now. Doesn't say it's not a concern. It's just not today's concern. So there you go. Chris Owens, mini game ball. Hey, you all know I'm a serious Tide fan, but I'm also a whiskey guy. You know I like my brown waters. Apparently Facebook does too, and we're all better for it. Recently, up popped an ad for Legends Drinkware glasses.
and it was easily the coolest thing I'd seen in a while. But wow, now that I have these in my hands, I'm blown away. You know our Crimson Tide is rooted in tradition, class, and style. Somehow, the crew at Legends Drinkware distilled each of these elements into their glasses. No detail is overlooked. Lead-free, crystal glass, hand-blown in America. Even the packaging is top shelf. And the gem-like logo? Well, it calls out to you. Roll Tide with every sip.
All right, now let's flip the field on defense. And, I think part of the story, I was holding back. Of course, the Alabama offense was dominant. We did mention some turnovers. But part of what allowed the offense to be so dominant is the defensive play. And so as we flip the field, let's think about the dominance on the defense. Defensively, Alabama held Arkansas to 5 of 15 third downs. In the meat of the game, in the early portion of the game, when it mattered, Alabama defense held Arkansas to 1 of 8 on third downs. That is significant. Alabama held Arkansas to 188 total yards. That's 188 yards. That is an incredible. I need to repeat that. 108 of those passing, 80 yards rushing on 43 carries. Arkansas averaged 1.9 yards per carry. Now, that's a dominant defense. That is a dominant defense. That's a component. That's an element that we've been looking for. There it is, folks, against Arkansas. Don't underestimate the fact that it's just Arkansas. Yeah, it's an Arkansas team that scored 48 points a week ago. This is an Arkansas team that knows how to score points. They have had success scoring points this season. That's not their strong suit. They're not an offensive juggernaut, but they have a lot more struggles, this Arkansas team does, than their ability to score points offensively. Again, they scored 48 points last week. Alabama held them to 3 points this Saturday, inclusive of 3 shutout quarters. I haven't run the numbers to see shutouts over the last, since the halftime at Georgia. It's a big number. Alabama is shutting out a lot of opponents. I know there was a full shutout in there, I believe Mississippi State, and there was at least 2 teams, Kentucky and Arkansas, both only scored 3 points. So that's 3 out of 4 quarters. And I know there's others. I think Tennessee, we shut them out for only 2 quarters, or for 2 quarters. And I think the same of Auburn. Point is, the defense, from a scoring perspective, has played very, very well. A new component, a new element that this defense really sort of blossomed or burst on the scene Saturday is the defensive line, the play of the defensive line. Say it with me, 8 sacks. Now, you can lament the Arkansas offensive line, and you would be justified in doing that, but 8 sacks is phenomenal. They were 10 tackles for a loss. Christian Barmore and Will Anderson both had 2 sacks. And again, there were 8 sacks across the team, some half sacks. So there were some shares. So there's about 7 individuals that got at least a partial sack attributed to them. That is, for my money, that's pretty darn amazing. That is demonstrative of the defensive line being a weapon, which is something we've forecasted, something we've been expecting to see. I did not expect to see it so transparently today. And I do recognize we might not see this type of outburst from the defensive line. Some of it is opponent-based, but they know how to do it. They have a muscle memory for it. And I think we're going to see some stellar play from the defensive line as we continue forward. There were turnovers. There were 4 turnovers. What's interesting, 1 was an interception, which is always great. Brian Branch in the secondary pulling that down. Here's what's interesting. There were 3 fumbles. And so multiple plays with individuals reaching out, knocking the ball out, active, hands active, watching the ball, watching the play, reaching in, making plays. That is outstanding play. And that is the type of production that we want to continue to see from the defensive line. So a tremendous hats off to the defense, to Pete Golding, to Freddie Roach, all the work that they're doing across the defensive front. I know I'm saying line, and there's the linebackers as well. Pete Golding manages the linebackers with Sal, and so they're doing a phenomenal job. The front 7 I think is playing well. And really you could say the front six, because we play a lot of time. They're playing very, very well. Byron Young probably had his best stat sheet of the day. He was in on seven tackles. He had three solos. He had half a sack. Barmore, two sacks we've talked about. He was in on three tackles, came very close to a scoop and score. DJ Dale actually recovered, but Barmore was right there. And then Tim Smith, young Timmy Smith in the middle, number 50. If you've not focused in and watched him play, watched him on some snaps, do yourself a favor. Go back and watch a game when he's in there. He is a disruptive force. He was in on three tackles, had two solo. He had a sack, and he had 1.5 TFLs. So he is playing very well. We mentioned Brian Branch with his interception. And this is Brian Branch did the intercepting. He did the catching there, right? But this is one of those, you know, you affect the quarterback in a lot of different ways beyond just sacks. And this is a play, if we had a segment where we telestrated a play and talked it through, then we would break it down in that way. And so as best as I can, sort of just verbally, this was a play where they ran a little sneaky-aroo. And so the quarterback, I can't remember, it was an end around or he threw it out wide, but behind the line of scrimmage, and the receiver ended up throwing the ball. And so let's pause there, right? So what are they doing there? What they're doing is they're trying to slow down the rush. The quarterback stands back in the pocket. He's your focal point. As a defensive lineman, you're focused on the quarterback, especially if you have a quarterback with suspect mobility, you're going after that guy. And so one of the ways, if you have a mobile quarterback, then they can scamper, they can get around, and it makes it harder to get after him. If you have a quarterback that's less mobile, one of the things you can do is quickly get the ball out of the hand of the quarterback. And so what they did is throwing to the wide receiver out in the flat behind the line of scrimmage, you know, 1,000 balls out, that slows down the rush. Now if they get to the court, it doesn't matter. They're not impacting the play and they're not impacting the ball. And so the play call to throw it out to the wide receiver and let the wide receiver throw it, the play call there is a function of the rush. It's a function of the defensive line getting to the quarterback. So that play call is in response to, we got to get our quarterback some time. We've got to do something. We need some long developing plays, getting guys downfield, and our quarterback can't hold the ball long enough because we can't block these guys, these monsters up front. So the play call was an intentional attempt to overcome or override the pressure from the defensive front. So that's sort of the first piece of it. So now you've got, as a result of the defensive front, you've got a non-quarterback throwing the ball. And so that can oftentimes lead to bad decisions. You can also have a wide receiver where I may never get to throw the ball again in my collegiate career, so I'm going to let it rip. And you can do that even when you know it's not the right decision. A good quarterback will say, I got to live to fight another day. I'm not just going to chuck this up. Some do. But as a rule, a quarterback should say, I value the ball. I'm not just going to chuck it up. When you give it to a receiver, a lot of that's out the window. Because a lot of receivers, you're going to let me throw it? I'm going to throw it. You very rarely see a receiver in that situation take the ball down and try to figure out something else. And certainly they're not reading a progression, right? They don't have very many options at that point. And so we've called the play to get out of the quarterback to complete the rush. Now we've got it over on the wide receiver. And the play design, and let's also say we're getting pressure on this thrower of the ball too, this receiver. And then the play design is all the way back across the field, which is a bad design just anyways. You don't throw back across the field, even if you think you're wide open as a wide receiver. So at any rate, a couple of bad decisions there. The ball's thrown and it's intercepted by Brian Branch. And so I love Brian Branch. The coverage, the sticking with the play when it looks like it's going a different way, everything he did there was 100% exactly right. When the ball's in the air, he basically boxed out the receiver and made a beautiful interception. All of that is phenomenal. But don't lose sight that it was the defensive front that caused that interception. It was the play of the defensive front that led to the butterfly effect, if you will, that led to that play call, additional pressure. Now we've got a non-quarterback throwing the ball that he's not going to throw it because of the circumstance. And then it leads to an interception. So that's the whole team sort of working together for a positive outcome there. Daniel Wright, I thought, played very, very well. He had a couple of open field tackles, really nice discipline, sort of breaking down, making the tackle. Those are the types of tackles that he would not have made earlier in the season. He is playing more of a center fielder. I don't know if I read this or heard the commentator speak to it, but he does seem much more comfortable in his role. If we think about early in the season, and we can think that Ole Miss game, and I'm reaching a point where you can throw out the Ole Miss game because the personality of that defense is very different than the personality of the defense that we have now. Think of, you know, Malachi Moore was in his third start as a collegiate. He started 10 games now, and I would, you know, you'd call him a vet. He's no longer a freshman, a true freshman, I think, is in sort of the vernacular. We were running, Alabama was running DeMarco Hellams as the dime, which I like his talent. I like rotating him onto the field, but that's not his skill set. Daniel Wright was still getting the most playing time in his career. And so the responsibility that he had, he wasn't a true freshman, but he was still growing, evolving into his play. And at that point, he certainly had a long ways to go. And then Brian Branch, who is a staple, he is the dime back now. He was not, I don't even think he played the first part of the season, certainly not maybe with the backups, but Brian Branch was not a starter at the money where he is now. If we went back and played that Ole Miss game again, you'd get an entirely different outcome. The game wouldn't be nearly as close. So I'm at the point, I mean, you can't throw it out like it didn't exist, but if you're assessing the defense, I think it's fair to discount that game a little bit because the unit that the Tide is rolling out at this point in the season is completely different than it was in week three. I do want to feature a player. I've been remiss the last couple of weeks for not commenting on the play of Christopher Allen. He had a sack Saturday. He has had four sacks on the season, most of those coming in sort of the second half of the season. He has had two forced fumbles again over the last half of the season. He's a player that is, in effect, maybe not literally, but in effect, he's making a play a day. And, you know, maybe not a play that's going to be the winning margin or the winning differential in these games with the points that Alabama's putting up, but he is making an impact play, at least one every game. If it's a key tackle on a third down, if it's a batted ball, if it's a forced fumble, if it's a sack, he has been active, making tremendous plays, in the second half of the season. And so I've not specifically called him out. He probably could have a whole closet full of mini game balls at this point, and I haven't done it. So I definitely, wanted to have a little feature section on, Christopher Allen because he is playing, lights out. And then, I'm going to wrap this into a mini game ball. And let me get there. First play of the game, almost diabolically, Christian Harris goes down with an injury. It doesn't look like anything that's so significant. It didn't look like, oh, obviously this is what happened on that play. He wraps up a guy, a receiver on a slant, and then just their bodies sort of spin. And it looked like sort of the full weight of them coming down came right down on Christian's shoulder. But even watching the replay, that's where you look at it and say, that's where it must have happened. But even watching it, you don't say, you know, that's not something that doesn't happen 100 times a game. And so, you know, hopefully at the point of this recording, there has been no definitive news. I think he's having an MRI today on Sunday. So by the time you hear this, you will likely know what the outcome is. Hopefully he's going to be back in time to play against Florida. This is that game, that Arkansas game, where we knew that we wanted to play it. We wanted to have it under our belts, but we did not want anyone to get hurt in this game. And to the extent that we would likely rotate the rosters in a way to get people out. And we did. Alabama did. A lot of the star players didn't play after the after halftime. It just so happened first play of the game, you know, Christian Harris goes down. And so we wish him well and a speedy return and healthy return, not only for Florida, but beyond that. And so all of that is true and legit and real. And we're going to transition into probably the biggest mini game ball that we've given in quite a while. And that's Jalen Moody stepping in at the middle linebacker position. You know, we can talk about Chris Owen stepping in for Evan Neal, and he did that. And hats off, we've given him a mini game ball. Hats off for him stepping in and his play in that circumstance. But he had multiple days to practice and get ready for that. He went to bed the night before knowing that he was going to start. His teammates knew that. So there was a readiness. And I'm not downgrading, but I'm differentiating. Jalen Moody probably went to bed saying, hey, in the second half, I might get some run because we are going to rotate guys over. So he probably went to bed in that regard. He had zero expectation that play two of the game, he's in there for the duration. He's in there for the rest of the game. The way Christian went out, clearly it was a shoulder MRI. There was a report that it looked like, you know, potentially is it bruised? Is it separated? We don't know. Had it been separated, I think we would know that. And I say that for two reasons. During the broadcast, they specifically said that he jogged into the tunnel, into the locker room. And not to mince words, you know, or splice words too much, but if he has a separated shoulder, he's not jogging. That's just the reality of it. And so it could be bruised, it could be dinged, and he could do a light jog. That's probably more true. If they had diagnosed it, and you know, you get in there and you get under the pad and you start sort of feeling around, I do think they would be able to diagnose, hey, it was a separated shoulder, we put it back in, we're going to do an MRI to see the damage. Well, you're not hearing that. We're saying what you're hearing is we don't know what it is. We're going to do an MRI. So both would get an MRI. One would say it was out, we put it back in, now we're going to look for damage. What we're hearing is we don't know what it is. We're going to do an MRI and look for what's going on. And so I think pretty clearly it's not a separated shoulder. That all of that means is there's an increased likelihood that it's not significant and that it won't keep him out multiple weeks. But this is armchair MD here. So do not don't take that for any more than that. Certainly be being optimistic. But let's go back to Moody because that's what I want to talk about. 42 stepping in at the middle linebacker position. One of the leading tacklers on the day. He was in on seven, had four solos, half a TFL. And I thought he played phenomenal. If we think about Christian Harris, he's a little smaller than Christian Harris. So he's a little light in the pants, but he's fast and he's mobile and he can get around and he makes plays in that direction. There's probably been some speculation. Well, why didn't Shane Lee play? And if you take Christian Harris and you go in one direction, more of a thumper linebacker, you get Shane Lee. If you take Christian Harris and you go the other way and you say a little bit smaller, but with the mobility, you get Jalen Moody. And so I think they're both like a degree and a half separation from Christian Harris. They're just in different directions. And so when you think Alabama's base defense is a lot of nickel, which way are you going to go? Are you going to go a big thumper that maybe isn't as mobile, or your intention is to play a mobile defense? And so you're going to go in the direction of Jalen Moody. So here's a guy that started the season, maybe some would speculate as the second or third, you know, maybe the third linebacker, and looks like he's worked his way up. He's number two, and it's going to be interesting to see what kind of rotation he, because he acquitted himself very well. If there was any questions, is he up for the challenge? Well, the answer is yes. And so even if Christian Harris comes back, do we now have some newfound depth at the middle linebacker position? Can that afford rotation for Christian Harris to get a breather, or for Moses to get a breather? I think it does. And then does that afford Jalen more of an opportunity as we get into the postseason and next season? I certainly think it does. And so I'm certainly proud of the young man. He's been around for a little bit. Looked like sort of the sun had set on his opportunity. And then the Arkansas game came along. One thing I will say, and I fight my own urge to read too much into this, but he played late into the game. Jalen Moody did. And so there's a, my initial sort of read on that is we are trying to get him as many reps as we can. We want to give him every single rep that we can so that he is ready to see things faster for future games. And so when we saw all backups in and Jalen Moody still in, part of me said, well, of course he's with the backups. This is when he would normally play. But if he's going to be a starter for future games, you think, well, you would take him out with the starters. But you might also say, this guy needs as many reps, as many snaps as we can absolutely get him. And so, you know, we leave him in for that reason. Very easy to start double crossing or double guessing and overthinking the logic there. So I'll stop just short of that. But it was for me an interesting observation. We didn't bring in Ali Cahoe. We did eventually bring in Shane Lee, but we didn't, you know, but we kept Jalen Moody out there. So certainly something to keep an eye on. All right. Let's transition to special teams. Special tip of the cap to Will Reichert. He did nail a 45-yard field goal. Very, very nice. He was 7 of 7 on his PATs, so he was perfect on the day. And if you'll lean in real closely, we're going to whisper this so no one hears us. Will Reichert is perfect on the season, which is phenomenal. There was a special video put out by the university talking about Mac Jones being the best holder in the country. And it was a little tongue-in-cheek, the video is. You got to go find it. But he performed very well in that capacity Saturday. So let's be proud of that. I'm trying to be a little tongue-in-cheek myself there. Charlie Scott had 2 punts. They were solid. It was a long of 39, but an average of 36, 37.5. So there was a tight clustering. Those are not outstanding punts. Neither of those, the stat sheet that I looked at, were inside the 20. Those are not outstanding punts, but they're consistent punts, and they're coverable punts. And so, again, I think we're floor setting here as opposed to ceiling popping. Might we get in a situation where we really need to push an opponent back and do something different with a punter? I wouldn't rule it out. But as a rule, if we feel like we are in control of the game, then we are comfortable with the shorter punts, that we feel a high degree of confidence and comfort in covering. So I'm not speculating that we're going to do something there, but if you see someone that's not Charlie Scott go in, then sort of assess, hey, what is the circumstance here in this game? And if you find yourself like, hey, we need something, an opponent really is running over us and we need to push them back to give our defense more of a chance, then I would speculate, you know, watch for something there. Not again, not predicting, but these are the things you watch for. Smitty, I think he heard last week's podcast where I said the path to Smitty winning the Heisman went straight through him returning punts for a touchdown. Now, I was thinking in against Florida and against the bigger opponent in sort of a championship stage, but Smitty was not patient with that idea. He ran literally with it against Arkansas, which was phenomenal because he ended up with a special teams touchdown on a day where otherwise his offensive production was less than, because we talked about the Arkansas defense. So hats off to Smitty for that play. Tell me, you know, how easy did he make that? Some of that's going to be Arkansas's punt coverage without a question. But when Smitty, you know, stuck his foot in the ground and cut up field, for Mamani, there was a burst that he showed Saturday that he did not have in prior seasons. And that's not to say he's not a fast wide receiver. They're all faster than I am. But the strength and conditioning, they have showed graphs, and they've sort of masked the players. But if you kind of, you know, sort of understand what they're trying to communicate, you know, they ran the numbers, the 40-yard sprints, and who gets to speed faster versus who has the higher end. And Smitty had a high end that was as fast is anyone. He just got there not as fast. And that was something that they specifically worked on with the strength and conditioning program. And so when he turned up field and sort of hit sort of the open turf, he got up to speed faster than I've ever seen him, you know, get up to speed, if you will. And so there was a gear that he hit that he accelerated through very, very quickly. So that was fun to see. Brian Robinson had a one kick return for 10 yards. And which by definition is bringing the ball out to the 10 and, or thereabouts. And so we know what I think about that. All right. Next up, Passes Prologue. Again, I'm sort of hung on that line of thinking because I 100% agree. Next up is the SEC Championship game. I would say for the Florida Gators, who Alabama will face in Atlanta next week. Florida is coming off, I would say, a very embarrassing loss to LSU. Not just the loss to LSU, which is embarrassing by itself, but how they lost, the emphasis, the exclamation mark. It would have been less ugly if they had taken the game into overtime and something happened, somebody tripped and fell or something. But with what they did to lose that game, incredibly embarrassing. That is, I don't care what Dan Mullen says, that is their second loss of the season. That a high degree of likelihood knocks them out of the playoff. If they beat Alabama in a close game, I think Alabama still gets in, but I don't think Florida would. And that's in there's other factors involved there, but that's probably what I do right now. This is Florida's eighth straight game, and it's Alabama's fifth straight game. This is 8 of 11. So an 11 of this game will be 11 for both teams. 8 of 11 consecutive for Alabama. That's 5 out of 11 consecutive. That is a big difference. That 8 is a number that stands out to me and will for a while. If we remember back in time, we nearly lost in 2009. Alabama nearly lost to Tennessee, the 8th game of the season. And that's the Mount Cody block, Lane Kiffin, the Tennessee head coach. That's a game that Alabama had every right to lose, were not a couple of exceptional special teams plays. And there's something about that, you know, 6-7, that 8th game, it's just the mind can't will itself over the beatdown that the body has taken. And so I do think there's materiality to Florida playing their 8th game. They're going to come out with energy. They're going to come out excitement. They're going to come out. They may even have a lead at some point in the game. But when you get into the deep recesses of the third quarter and into the fourth, they're going to have a level of exhaustion, a level of depletion that Alabama will not. And so factor that into the thought process and watch for it, because I think it's real and I think it will happen. How will all of that sort of in mind, how will Florida react when they get punched in the nose? Both teams will get punched in the nose in this game. It's a championship game in the SEC. Both teams will get punched in the nose. Florida is, they were not picked to win the East. They were not picked to be there. There's been some unravel this weekend. And so at what point do they say, 8 games in, haven't achieved more than what was expected, at what point do they say, no mas? At what point might they say, we've accomplished more than we thought we could accomplish, I'm done, versus an Alabama team less depleted and their biggest goals, the biggest goals that they set for themselves last January, last December. They still have an opportunity for those goals to come to fruition. And so if they get punched in the nose, I don't think Florida may stop and think, like, do I want to keep doing this? Alabama will say, yes, I have already committed to keep doing this. And I think again, sort of later in the game, second half, if it's a to and fro game, I think that manifests. I think we see that sort of come to bear. So keep an eye on that. You know, if we start looking at stats, Florida's run game and Florida's defense, for my money, they remain a little suspect. Scoring defense, you can talk about yardage, you can talk about third down conversion, you can talk a lot about it, you know, passing and rushing. At the end of the day, it's scoring. Mullen likes to think it's yards according to his halftime, but at the end of the day, it's scoring. And Florida is 48th ranked in scoring defense. Alabama's 11th, about a 10-point differential, 10.5-point differential there. Rushing offense for Florida is ranked number 100, and Alabama is not outstanding, but it's 40. It's ranked 40th, and I would venture that Najee is the best running back in the country. So call it the distribution, but there's a talent, there's a weapon there that I don't think Florida does. So I think there's a couple of dimensions that Alabama has that Florida doesn't have. I think Florida is a very, very good team. I think Alabama is potentially a great team. And I think that differential comes to bear. Again, I think both teams punch each other in the mouth. I think there's some to and fro early, but I'm looking at a 38-24 style ball game. Trask, if he's on, and the tight end, Kyle Pitts, if he plays, have no reason to think that he wouldn't. They will give Alabama some trouble, but I think there's a solution, and I don't know that there's a call it a diversity of offensive firepower that Florida has, much in the same way that Alabama does. So if it becomes a shooting match, I don't think Florida can hang with them. But I think it's probably a slower style game, a slower pace game, a little more feeling each other out. It's a championship game. It's not unusual in those types of circumstances. So I'm predicting a 38-24 style ball game. And with that, this has been another edition of the Alabama Football Podcast. You know what to do. Roll Tide.
Thanks for listening to the Alabama Football Podcast. We love that you're tuned in and hope that you enjoyed the show. We encourage you to reach out and let us know what you like, where we can improve, or just to shout out a Roll Tide. We are where you are. iTunes, Facebook, Twitter, email newsletters, t-shirts, free roster downloads, and of course, on the web at alabamafootballpodcast.com. Check us out where you'll find easy links to your favorite way to follow the Tide. Got that, Coach?
Aye.
Of course. Roll Tide.